evening. This is side two of tape number 360. It's October the 27th, 1978. While I was in New Orleans, I had several people at my home, several friends. One, his name is Jean Durkas, and she worked with the Diggers up in San Francisco at the time of the Haight-Ashbury movement. And Jean was the first person to tip me off about the hippies being killed with poison and acid and being driven crazy, that these chemicals were brought in to drug them and purposely to break up the movement. And also there was another friend at the house who lives in Los Angeles by the name of Vic Spiegel. And then at Marvin was at the home, my son Marvin Goodwin, who was going to the University of California in Santa Cruz. He was 19 at the time, and he was writing songs for Bobby Darin. Bobby had given him a base pay of $150 a week just to have the first write to any songs that he'd want, because Marvin had started writing songs, and Bobby thought he had the most talent of any person he had seen around, and he liked Marvin, so he just put him on a retainer fee and was going to produce these songs. And at the house were Carolyn and Pete Gilman. Gilman had been a newspaper man, a writer. He wrote the book Diamond Head. He was at Vietnam during the war. He was with the admirals over in Honolulu. He'd been parties with Jackie Kennedy at the time. Peter had a home down at the Highlands. He has property all over Carmel. Our piano tuner rents a house that Peter Gilman owns in Carmel. And he always says to me, I know you think Pete's a spy, but he's not. He says, just because he picks up the phone and talks to Aristotle Onassis, it's just somewhat of a personal call. He lets out that little story, you know, about Pete's links to Onassis. And at the time of the assassination attempts and riots in France, he was there when de Gaulle was under fire by the same group, exposed the Permandex team that later killed John Kennedy, Robert Kennedy. And in future tapes, I'm going to do some more about Permandex. Well, Pete and Carolyn with Marvin, when these other friends were there, and they gave him what was supposed to be acid, and Vic said, wait, what are you giving? And I said, oh, it's just acid. He'll just have a trip. And Vic says, well, I'm not going back to Los Angeles if you do this. And she said, no, we'll take him to Big Sur. He'll be all right. And so Jean went back to San Francisco. Vic went to L.A., and then that began what was a nightmare for 10 years. I mean, a literal nightmare. Marvin went to Santa Cruz, got as far as Santa Cruz. He had his own car and drove it there and called my husband and myself, and he'd gone out of his mind. I came home from New Orleans and was at the house, and Marv was up at college, and it seemed that those 5 or 10 days before I heard from him, he had been totally crazy and gone out of his head and didn't contact me. You know, I didn't know where he was. I thought he was doing fine and getting his classes together. It was a fall semester. They were getting ready to start, and I didn't think anything about it, and he called, and Bill went up to get him, and he couldn't find the key to his car. It was thrown away, and he was practically out of his mind, and he was catatonic, and we brought him home, put him in the bed between us. He was stiff and a simulated heart attack, and my first husband is a pediatrician and always took care of the medical needs of the family, the two boys and the three girls, and so he said, we'll get Marvin down here. I can get the best doctors, blah, 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 and I didn't know in 1967 what the CIA was doing, or I didn't know that he had ingested anything until a few weeks later when I talked to Vic and Jean that were at the house. So Marvin was flown down and put into a hospital in Los Angeles, and that began a chain reaction of doctors whose names I won't mention on the tape, but someday I really want to sue, and they began a plan right away to send him to Chestnut Lodge in Maryland, which later, when I began to investigate, it was a CIA hospital, which is named in the book. The story of Judith Beckstein writes about her ordeal of how she was politically active in the Kennedy assassination in Chicago and was given some champagne, and a drug had been inserted through the cork, and she went crazy and was put in the CIA hospital, Chestnut Lodge, and she hinted that Artie Brammer was trained or programmed there, that assassins were trained or programmed there. And I called there, and it was run by admirals. And Dr. Eric Byrne had known Marvin. Marv was in group therapy with him at the time. Eric Byrne wrote the book Games People Play. And he called down there the doctors, and he said, no, he's not schizophrenic. He has exactly the symptoms they gave him at the time that are in the Senator Church Committee hearings of the LSD that you administer. And then you call in a doctor, and he diagnoses a paranoid schizophrenic, but it's not, we won't tell them that they ingested this LSD plus these various chemicals that they inserted into it, and I have the names of them, and they've come out since. So Eric Byrne called down and told the doctors that Marvin was anything like that, that he was outgoing. He was the extrovert in the family of all the children, and a lot of talent, and he had things really under control and together. And he'd gone to a private school in Arizona, Verde Valley, where 2 years there, David went 4 years, not a hint or a diagnosis, you know, of insanity, of malfunction, of schizophrenia, no personality work, got out of, schizophrenia symptoms. He was working as a normal person, studying, graduating, went on to the University of California, was working for Bobby Darin. So this process of putting him first there and then Mount Sinai Hospital, where they locked him up, and luckily he had a dime, and he called me and told me they were shipping him away, and I'm convinced that he would be dead or would have had a lobotomy by now. And he called me. Again, as luck would have it, that one dime did it. Like the unsinkable Molly Brown, sometimes I think I should just put these things into a book. He had a dime and called and said, they're shipping me back there. And I got an attorney, Jerry Barron, and we went down to Los Angeles, and the court records said the attorney, who was my husband's brother, said that he didn't know the parent of Marvin Goodwin. He knew the father, but I was a legal guardian. We were divorced, and he didn't know where I was. And he was married to my first cousin, the attorney that was shipping him to Chestnut Lodge, along with, well, it's Dr. Marmer. I'll tell you his name, Dr. Marmer from Mount Sinai Hospital. Back to this. And I called Marmer, and I said, have you ever sent any patient there before? And he didn't have any. I said, how do you know about Chestnut Lodge? Why are you sending Marvin? And Eric Byrne knew Marvin before all this came on and could give the exact symptoms if there were hearings today on what happens when you take this poison or the person before. But right after that, Eric Byrne, the writer, was walking along Carmel Beach, and he died of a heart attack. He passed out, and his close friend, who was my attorney, Jerry Barron, in the case, gave the eulogy for Eric Byrne. It was a simple ceremony, and he read the services. And Jerry Barron had gone to Los Angeles to fight the guardian, Mr. Kristofich, down there, who later was removed because he was corrupt and was a thief and was removed from office. Again, the county conservator there, they took Marvin's money and savings and were to ship him to Chestnut Lodge. Jerry Barron was our attorney, and Eric Byrne had seen Marv in group therapy. Marv was going to Santa Cruz, but he had trouble relating to longtime friend associates. He was talented and extroverted, but his close personal friends, he had trouble, and he thought if he went to Eric Byrne, and particularly after the games people play, that if he went into this, he'd understand better, you know, his relationship with other people. And he was working this out with Byrne. And so Byrne died, and Jerry Barron gave the eulogy, and a week later, Jerry Barron died. So that the only two people that could ever stand by me, and I was fighting my husband at the time, he thought Marvin should go to Chestnut Lodge. In fact, that was a big wedge in our marriage at the time, because Bill thought that let them do whatever they want with him, he's crazy, and I said, no, he's been poisoned. And the girls turned against Bill, and there was a lot of conflict over this. And so Byrne was dead, and Jerry Barron was dead. And that was the same summer that David had the car accident, having dinner with Lee, who teaches at the DLI, the Defense Language School, the only location that Reinhard Galen ever attended. Head of Hitler's Intelligence Eastern Division, flew to the Pentagon, flew out here to Monterey to the DLI, where there's a nest of white Russians and Nazi agents, and then flew back to Germany, where he had a villa protecting him from war crimes and so forth. David had the car accident. He was thrown out of the car, and that was after having dinner with Lee. When I came home from New Orleans, I was traumatized. I was dizzy, and a doctor friend of ours who's at the University of California, who's also a lawyer, Jim Nielsen, a close friend, said, oh, the reason you're dizzy is they probably gave you some radiation in Dallas. See, the police officers came up to the seat that I was on the airplane when the bomb scare came. They said, will you come here? And they put me in a door, and they guarded the door, and I had to sit on a chair in the back of the room while they went through everybody's luggage and opened their cameras and the praline nuts and so forth. And I kept saying to them, well, why don't you talk clean? The whole city is smeared because of the Kennedy assassination. Why do you cops keep this up? Why are you doing this to me? But anyway, I was dizzy, and the bed was going around. I was really reeling. I don't know whether it was a trauma of being followed, someone at the airport then following us when I came home, or keeping my research that I had done. I was trying to make the connections for Jim Garrison of the Dallas-Fort Worth area to the Clayshaw connections and the Reinhardt-Galen Nazi connections. I was trying to piece it together for him, and I came home and was reeling. And then I went to the bookstore, the Thunderbird bookstore, which is now a large operation bought out by other people, is owned by Jim and Corinne Smith, out in the valley. And my friends and I used to call it the Casbah, because we believe that this is where all the spies met. And there was a couple that wanted to meet me and wanted to know about Jim Garrison and wanted to know about what I did in New Orleans. They heard that I'd been to New Orleans, and about the arrest of Clay Shaw. And they came on as a book publisher, and his wife, Teo Savory, brilliant. He had a bookstore, or maybe still has, in Santa Barbara, and they showed me these peace postcards. They did, you know, the round circle with the peace insignia, and oh, it was the anti-war period, and they printed peace insignia. And well, when Bill Turner was at my house, I had had dinner with Bill in New Orleans, and he, as a researcher, came to Carmel Valley. He plays tennis here and comes here. He just finished this new book, The Assassination of Robert Kennedy. And when I mentioned to him about Teo Savory Brilliant and her husband, he got from Jim Garrison for me the list of people whose names were in the address book of Clay Shaw that Jim Garrison had in New Orleans. And it seemed that they shared an apartment with Clay Shaw in Mexico, and they were very close to Clay Shaw, and they came on as just people visiting Carmel and printing peace insignias with just a curiosity. Also, I was invited to the Highlands and to have lunch with a group of people who wanted to talk about New Orleans and the Kennedy assassination, what was going on back there in New Orleans. And by that time, Jim Nielsen, the attorney living here, was helping me, and he said, don't go anywhere without a camera and take pictures of people if they're behind you or with you, or if they appear at two or more places. And I went up and had lunch, and I have the names of the people, interesting cast of characters that were there. And then they were going to sit in this veranda room and talk about New Orleans and Clay Shaw. And I took out my camera and I said, well, before I talk about these things and I've had lunch with people, I always have to photograph them on the advice of my lawyer to know who I'm sharing this information with. So I went around the room and photographed them one by one and said, thank you very nice much for the nice luncheon. And I left. Now, that was on advice from my lawyer, and I did that, and I still have their names and pictures. About 1966, 67, just before I went to New Orleans, I was writing a play called Tiger by the Tail about Jack Ruby. Now, it was earlier than that. I have to look up the date. It must have been around 65. And we moved up, it was just when we moved up to the Carmel area, and we left West Los Angeles and moved up here, and there was a house across the street, a dentist lived in. He had just bought it, and he had a small child. There were swings and slides, and I was glad because my four children were in school, but Diane was just 3 years old, and I was glad there were children in the neighborhood. Well, within 1 or 2 days after we moved in, the slides and swings came out. The house was sold. The family, the dentist, moved out, the wife and family, and in came a man that I later accused of being military intelligence. His name is Mr. Campisi, and he bought the house on the corner. We lived on a cul-de-sac where you can't pass it without somebody seeing where you go, whether you go left or right or however you travel. From his point of view, his house faces both the street that I was on and the highway, Carmel Valley Road. And the neighbors began to call him the Sentinel because he was there night and day, and there was an interesting article about him recently in the Monterey Herald, a long article about his being in the military. And he has a big flagpole that he hangs up. And I always felt, all the time that I lived at that house, I moved from there about 4 years ago, that he was the Sentinel on the road and still is. And he sits in there in the garden and waves. I saw him at a party recently, and he said, "Why do you wave to me every time you pass?" But usually I always make a point of giving a great big wave to Campisi. My best friend was parked in the village yesterday and was next to a truck that had Fort Ord on it, and out came Campisi and is driving that car. He didn't come on as retired military. I went to his house once to talk to him about it because I did have my feelings that he was a plant from the military right out at that particular cross section. And when I went to talk to him about it, I was sitting in the living room, and he had a guest come in who didn't know who I was, and assuming, I guess, that we're all the same ilk. And the person that came in was a black guy who had been down to Limekiln Creek at Big Sur and had lived with the hippies in some tents and teepees for about 2 weeks and shared their grass and food. And he had a beard, and he was going back to Fort Ord to clean up and shave and go to the proper authorities, and then they were going to do a bust of them and arrest them and round them all up. They had befriended him, and he was talking about getting ready for the bust, but he had stopped at Campese's to get some questions about his dog, because Campese keeps these killer dogs, these police dogs, and trains them and sells them out for the police departments, and this guy had one of these dogs and was just checking on his puppy and talking about his counterintelligence work with Campese while I was there. And then when I came, take a breath here, when I came home from New Orleans in 1967, the plane incident, the bomb scare on the plane, took place in September, and then down about four houses from Campese, facing Carmel Valley Road, was a home owned by a man from military intelligence, and he went overseas. He'd been in Korea and Asia, and he all of a sudden rented a house, and my friend Louise James, who lived right next door, she rented from him a small bungalow, was really surprised that the way they moved out, because she knew them and had a working, talking relationship with these people, rented from them, and they didn't say they were going overseas and didn't say they were moving, and she had no indication. And just all of a sudden, they were up and out, and a new family moved in. And this family had a military truck Louise saw move their things in, which isn't unusual because the family was owned by a military family. And on the peninsula, they do rent houses to the people going to Fort Ord or Navy postgraduate school and so forth. But out of this van came this hippie man and a hippie wife and their four hippie kids. Fifth came later. In fact, we were so close, I drove them to the hospital when they had their last baby, Carlotta. I got to know them quite well, and Diane was friendly with their daughter, Michelle. We always called her Spy Baby. But this family moved in right next to Louise James, and their name was Winan, Carolyn and Charles Winan. And Charles Winan is the man who is suing Paul Krasner now in Rolling Stone, so I'll do more on him later. But he is the man that moved in next door to my friend Louise James, and so we felt always that this was a counterintelligence group. And then Winan began to publish just before the Manson murder in 1969. He did the drawings for a book called Children of Change, and the publisher was Kaiser, Henry Kaiser from San Francisco area, and it was a put down on hippies and their violence and their lack of sense of humor at a time when the hippies had indicated no violence. The violence was coming from the Hell's Angels on the outside, and probably the hippies were the greatest bunch with their sense of humor that had come along, and the testament to that is my collection of buttons, which I have saved over the years, about that period, and I have several thousand buttons, a great button collection, and it all started with the sense of humor of the hippies, and Wine was doing the illustrations for Kaiser, who later was identified with the CIA LSD drug program coming into Tulane University as well as other places, and they again were recipients of the Howard Hughes Medical Institute money, a whole can of worms, but this particular man and his family, disguised as hippies, were now down the street from us with children going to the same school. And I got to know them because I wanted to know them, but they were surrounding us. In May 1970, the World Affairs Council had a meeting here on the Monterey Peninsula, and it was the time of the Cambodia bombings and Kent State killing of the students, and Spiro Agnew was scheduled to speak. And I went to the GI Coffee House with my friend Louise James, the one that lived next door to Winans, who was later given some kind of drug where her memory and her mind are completely gone. We went to this meeting, and I wanted to make placards about Spiro Agnew saying, tell about your Greek connections. Spiro is a CIA agent. Spiro is linked to Tom Pappas of the CIA. And this was in 1970, and you have to appreciate that the Louis Tackwood allegations of the Squad 19 that they were getting ready to kill Nixon and make Agnew president. I wanted the people to demonstrate on the area against the war and against Agnew's being there by linking him to the Greek military junta, the fascism that had been put into power by the CIA in 1967, and then the links of the Greek military junta to the new vice president in 1968, Spiro Agnew, and the escalation of the war. Well, the reason I'm talking about the World Affairs Council incident is that I got new information on it, and now I'm almost convinced that this probably or possibly was one of the reasons for the accident that took place in December of 1970 to Bonnie and Barbara and the others, because the hippies and the protesters in the Bay Area, in the Monterey Peninsula, rather, there were quite a few of them, and they surrounded the conference grounds at Asilomar, where the World Affairs Council was meeting, and they climbed the roofs, and they were carrying on, and they didn't want any demonstrations there. This was a pretty peaceful peninsula. And so a gentleman who arranged the World Affairs Council meeting, at Sterling Cottrell, who had been in charge of counterintelligence in Southeast Asia and worked for the State Department, told these people, if you have a spokesman come who speaks to us, who represents you, get off our roofs, get off the beach, leave us. We'll let that spokesman speak for about 10 minutes to represent the street people. So Sterling Cottrell had said that, and so the people said, we want Mae Brussel. And they agreed if they would scram on Friday, I could come on Saturday. And I was located on Saturday, and I went out to Asilomar. Jerry Brown was out there this week. He calls that the poor man's Camp David. Everyone in the world except the president can have conferences at Asilomar. So I went out there Saturday night, and they said, no, I couldn't speak. And there was then a lot of problems because the promise had been made to the street people I could. So they decided to have a meeting Sunday morning early from 8 to 9 before the breakfast on whether or not I could speak. And they had a meeting of the board of directors of the World Affairs Council, which you must appreciate was set up by Mr. McCone, John McCone, who then became director of the CIA later. He was CIA director at the time that Kennedy was president, after Allen Dulles was fired. And they said, no, I couldn't speak. And when I came Sunday morning, the board of directors of the World Affairs Council said I couldn't. And yet I didn't leave the conference grounds, and there were policemen around me, about 8 of them, and 8 guarding the door that I wouldn't come in. And it's not my style to storm in anyway where I'm not wanted. I had been invited there. So a gentleman from Philadelphia, Sherman Chickering, a newspaper man, said, hang around. He sent a message, don't come in, but hang around outside the door. So I just read a book, which I brought, and Sherman Chickering was on the program, and I didn't know at all who he was at the time. He was just a man that said, stay. And he got up on the rostrum, and he told the people there, there were 300 or 400 in the hall, I'm supposed to speak in this time slot allotted from 10 to 11. I have the program in my files put away of various things that have happened to me and about me. The time slot was allocated. And he said, we made a promise to these people Friday night. The board has broken it, but by a show of hands, you can overturn the board. And they had a show of hands, and they allowed me to come in and speak. And they came outside and said, you can come in and speak. Well, I didn't know until 2 weeks ago, when I was talking to Sterling Cottrell on the phone, that Standard Oil, the vice president of Standard Oil, attending the World Affairs Councils, was the gentleman who said, if you let Mae Brussel speak for 10 minutes, we'll withdraw all money from the World Affairs Council, that you won't have your meetings. It won't happen. And if this happens, these Exxon Standard Oil people said, if she talks 10 minutes, we pull out of the World Affairs Council, which is like saying they won't run it anymore. It would have collapsed. Their little clubby would have collapsed. The only reason Sterling Cantrell told me that was I called him 2 weeks ago because he's trying to fight the takeover. 20th Century Fox has bought Pebble Beach property. And, of course, the beautiful Monterey Peninsula will become like Miami and New Jersey. The next step will be legalized gambling like Reno, I suppose, and Nevada, the gang from 20th Century Fox, are signing a deal to buy up the whole Pebble Beach property. And Sterling wanted to stop it, and I offered to help. And he said he thought it was funny that I was helping him because of his role in counterintelligence in Southeast Asia and with the State Department, which has nothing to do with preserving the peninsula. If he wants to preserve the peninsula, that's great with me. And keep it the way we wanted, and for the reasons many people are living here, instead of being a residence now, it has become an investment. And, of course, that happened to me and my family in Beverly Hills, the same thing, and now it's happening up here. But the importance of Standard Oil, it comes to my mind when he told me that, I flashed, because that was in May 1970. And then in July, I took a trip to Texas to see Penn Jones in Texas. And I took my daughter, Bonnie, the one that was killed in the car crash a few months later, and a friend, Joey, and my daughter, Diane. Barbara was going to Tahiti for a vacation, and the boys were busy. Marvin was still getting over his acid trip and couldn't travel at all. and David was in college, and I decided that I would just take these, Joey and Bonnie and Diane, and I had never seen Penn Jones. He'd been to the West Coast, and he said, hey, why don't you come? And I wanted to see Marguerite Oswald. I went to her home and met her, and we took this trip. Penn thought that one reason for the accident happening, could have happened, was my visit to Texas. But now that I think the power of Standard Oil and Exxon and Bruce Roberts in the Gemstone Files, he gave me the Gemstone Files, 350 pages, in August of 72 after the Watergate arrest, because I had broken that story on why was Martha Mitchell kidnapped. And in there he named Carlos Marcello and several persons from New Orleans who had set up the car accident that took place just outside of Fort Ord, where the fatal accident where Bonnie was killed. And I even put away what Bruce Roberts gave me in 72 and didn't want to read too much of that and didn't want to dwell on it until my head was really better ready to deal with that material. When we got to the hotel room in Texas, we checked into a motel, and it was in Arlington, Texas, between Fort Worth and Dallas. I called Penn, and I called Marguerite Oswald. And, of course, when I saw Marguerite the next day and went to her home, she said, you never call from, I don't know where you call from, gas stations or payphones or whatever. Because after we called her and went out to dinner, and we went back to our hotel room, there was a man outside the door with a big bullwhip. And he stood by our car, and he cracked that bullwhip all night and through the early evening. And when we went to our car, the girls were hot, and they wanted to get bathing suits or something. Or, you know, you travel to a motel, and you pull up, and your car is filled with garbage, empty. He stood by us and used that bullwhip and cracked it and cracked it. And it was terrifying, and I didn't know, again, whether something would happen at night. And sure enough, he had the room next to us with the connecting doors. And I couldn't lock my side. It was like New Orleans where the door lock was off after the first night. And I guess it's just dumb luck. I don't know. We stayed there that night. We went to a different place the next day. We checked out, and I never followed up and never asked who he was and never took the license plate. I think I went through all of these years mostly like in a state of shock. So many things were coming down, and I was dumber then. Now if there's a car parked on my property in Canada, I can say to you, hey, this guy's parked there, and here's the car number, and give you the license number. But I wasn't very smart in those days, and I never even dreamt that all of this was going to come down to me. Or even after that plane incident in New Orleans when I was taken off the plane in Dallas. In December in 1970, three people in the front seat of the Volkswagen van were driving in that front seat, and I'm sure that nobody could hit or guess which one of my children would be there or even be in the front seat, because actually there were six in back, and both of my girls could have been passengers and just injured. But Sharon Elliott, a teacher, she was a dance teacher, she was only 23 years old, and Bonnie Brussell, 14, and Cecilia Neal, whose father was in the State Department also, 16 years old, were sitting in the front seat of a Volkswagen van, which just went out of control. They were coming home from a dance class up at Cabrillo College and hit the back of a car driven by John Anthony Zavone, who was 41 at the time, from Watsonville. And there was a Steve Garcia from Fort Ord who received, in quotes, minor injuries. Three people were killed, and six were seriously injured. No, seven. Zavone was seriously injured, had his back broken, and was permanently paralyzed. The only person that walked away from the scene and then left the area and went AWOL from Fort Ord and then went to Utah was a man named Steve Garcia. And this program isn't about the details of the accident that took place, except to tell you that that would make a story in itself. And someday, when again I get my head straight, I will compile all of this and make a lawsuit against the federal government, if I live through it, to do it. That's one of the good things about the wine and trial in San Francisco, is that the trial transcript is going, we're going to bring out many of the things that did happen to me and why I was watching Charles Wine and what's happened to our family, and it will be court record and entered in the court. And I don't know if this is happening in any other court case so far in the country, at least I'm not aware of it. I know the drugging of Dr. Olson by the CIA with the acid they gave him was settled out of court, and many of these cases are settled out of court and they're not allowed to go to court. If I get a good, strong lawyer, I will take them to court. But that was in December of 1970. Oh, just prior to the accident, when Bonnie was killed and Barbara was so badly injured and almost killed, in the summer of 70 after the trip to Texas in the September. I took a quick trip with a friend up to Canada. He had to get some papers that were there, some passport papers and documents he needed. He was going to move to Sweden, and he needed these papers, and I said that I'd go up with him. And we went to Vancouver, and he told me not to leave the hotel room and stay there. People do have ways of entering hotel rooms, and he felt a little paranoid about this. I made the mistake of going out for breakfast. I never do obey. Well, he was out getting his papers, and there was somebody shuffling up papers and was in our hotel room and ran out. And at the motel where we stayed, the man told me they didn't have a maid doing the service there. She wasn't even dressed as a maid. But leaving Vancouver and going back to Grants Pass, coming back to the Carmel area just about 6 weeks before the accident in the fall, September of 1970, that's when our car went up in flames outside of Grants Pass, and we were almost blown up. The explanation had something to do with a shoe pin that was removed. I don't know the mechanics of a car. I might just continue on this saga from 1970 to 1978 to update you. I was going to do the Pope next week, but there's so many more things, and maybe it's good for you to have a record in case something does happen to me. It will be a record of things that took place during this time.